Welcome to From Idea to Impact, a podcast from Arabella Advisors that focuses on the people at the heart of our work. People who inspire us with their efforts to create positive change and impact in communities across the country and around the world.
Hi, this is From Idea to Impact, and I'm Rick Cruz, president of Arabella. I'm excited to be joined today by social entrepreneur, educator, activist, and movement builder, Gabrielle Wyatt. Gabrielle's also a friend and someone whose leadership across so many communities, organizations, and domains I've come to deeply respect. As we collectively reflect on Black history and women's history and commit to moving forward the work at the intersection of the two, I'm eager to share Gabrielle's latest and perhaps most important project. I'm pleased to introduce you to the Highland Project and the mission behind it, and I look forward to Gabrielle sharing her story, the legacy of her family, and how it informs the transformation she sought to achieve in society, specifically for the Black community. Thanks for joining, and I hope you enjoy this next episode of From Idea to Impact.
Gabrielle, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm really excited about getting to hear about what you're doing now and to share with our audience how you got here. And I want to get to the Highland Project, which I know is where you've been spending so much of your time over these last couple of years, but really want to give you the opportunity to start because I know where you've come from and what you've done before, and we've got a lot of shared connections, but I'd love for you to share with our podcast audience how you got to the place you are today.
Well, first, thanks for having me, Rick. And it's good to be with an old friend. And I'm excited to dig in today. You know me probably as Gabby, Gabby from outside of DC. I grew up, for listeners, in Baltimore, the better side of the Beltway, wars with DC. But I grew up in a family of educators. My parents met teaching back home. They would go on to have three girls. I'm the youngest of three. My sisters also teach back home. And so I grew up in this dynasty of Wyatt educators. And I had the privilege of going to magnet school for my middle and high school experience. And I say privilege because it was rare that you had an opportunity to leave your neighborhood, the neighborhood I was from, and access an incredible school where educators believed in your brilliance, no matter your seen or unseen identities. And I share that because as I watched my sisters accept this Wyatt family vocation, calling to become educators, I kept thinking, like, where and how will I uphold my family's legacy? Well, how will I uphold this dynasty? And I was, I'll never forget, I was about 16, 17 years old. I was studying acting in my magnet school, and I came across a playwright, Bertolt Brecht. And Brecht is a Holocaust survivor, and he created a type of theater that was meant to make you so uncomfortable, you would get up in the middle of the show and perform a political act. And at that time, I think I was really coming into, you know, my own views about the differences, what was really at root between the differences at the school I was going to and the school my father was teaching at, the school I was zoned for, frankly. And I got uncomfortable. I got uncomfortable that I had this privilege to go to this incredible school. And I had an educator who believed in me and said, you know what? You should run for school board. And so that's exactly what I did. I ran for Baltimore County School Board. I earned a full voting seat at age 17. And I frankly never looked back. I figured out that I really loved, had a fire in the belly for what I now will call structural change, for moving systems, for moving policies and resource flows in order to actualize our brilliance as Black kids in a Black community.
You have taken that experience, and you know, you and I got to know each other in education leadership, education reform work over the last decade, and I see that in the roles that you've taken, and you've now made this transition from one system that's connected to so many other places and other dynamics. And now really are looking at the intergenerational transition of a lot of things that are great and a lot of the broken systems that carry across. So I'd love to hear a little bit about how you made that transition. And you've served in so many different capacities, board member, philanthropist serving organization. I mean, so many different places.
Sure. Yes, you're right. I mean, I spent the last 10 plus years really digging into different seats of power to create structural change that for me at the core would equal multi-generational opportunity for Black communities. And I will forever have educational justice, the fire for it in my DNA. But I think in the last 5 years, I really grappled with, are we really creating multi-generational opportunity? And I think my first awakening, if you will, to this question was as I was reflecting on my time in Newark. I was in Newark shortly after the Zuckerberg gift announcement that everyone probably remembers on Oprah. And I led within Newark Public Schools. What does it mean to respond, one, to decades of corruption and frankly, the mistreatment of children? And two, how do you do that when there's this big philanthropic gift that was focused on increasing the number of high performing public charter schools? And in that time, part of my role was to really right size the district's footprint from buildings to schools to jobs. And I saw up close and personal what happens when we're reforming one system, education. What can be the unintended ripple consequences on another? And I would say the economic well-being of Newarkers. Newark Public Schools was the second largest employer. And its families, the same families enrolling their kids in public charter schools because they were doing right by their kids, were the same families that we had to discuss layoffs with as we were right-sizing the district's footprint. We were taking away the ability to put food on the table to keep roofs over heads. And I don't think we talk about that enough in education and in other sectors. What happens again when we're changing one? Are we really cutting off or shortchanging ourselves in the community in the lifting of all boats across this broad term of what I'll say multi-generational wealth? I'd say the second thing that brought me to the Highland Project was watching against the backdrop of all things 2020, increasing calls for leaders who look like the two of us, Rick, to sit in seats of power, but not really seeing there be the infrastructure in place to not only fund our ideas and our impact, but sustain us in our seats. And so I came to the Highland Project out of one believing that we really need to reset the conversation and frankly redefine the conversation about what does it mean to create multi-generational wealth? And two, how do we do that with Black women at the center of those solutions?
You touch upon so many important things, and I know you're going to talk about this in the context of explaining the Highland Project, which I want to get to in a second. That reflection on the journey in philanthropy, in particular for those driving educational justice and those funding it, is so, so important. And we're seeing some of the reflections of that in the politics of the current moment and in our fragmentation of what had been some agreement upon, you know, trying different things to support, in particular, kids of color from low-income communities. And I don't think we ever thought we had the silver bullet, but I think we thought we were moving forward in the right direction. And I love the vulnerability and the honesty of asking questions about just how much better are we making education for students, and what are the costs, or what are the opportunities for us to be doing it in a better way? And I think the lens of intergenerational success is a really powerful one for us to think about education, health, you know, economic empowerment. And I think that's what you're going to tell us you're trying to do with the Highland Project.
Yes, that's right. It's as if you knew my script. but that, you know, that is exactly what we're trying to do. And so I think just to keep listeners in our story of Newark, right? What I think we could have done differently in Newark is not that as Newark Public Schools, we would have solved for this challenge of where would parents work, right? But that we certainly would have created interdisciplinary tables to call more alarm to this broader challenge that was going to come for Newark families. That's what we could have done differently. And that's a prime example of what I think you would see from the leaders of the Highland Project do differently. And so at the Highland Project, we are in interdisciplinary and intergenerational growing coalition of Black women leaders who are driving systems change across communities, institutions, and systems in the pursuit of redefining and creating multi-generational wealth in their communities. And so our goal is that 5 years from now, we have a new definition of what does it mean to truly create and pass along to multiple generations wealth, and what are the policy solutions for getting there. For us, what you should expect from us over the next 5 years is that we are listening to and centering Black women in everything that we do. Every year, we will recruit, select, and invest in 15 women across sectors, across the country, and across generations. We will invest in their brilliance. We'll not only do that quite literally, we invest $100,000 in unrestricted capital in each leader, but we also invest in their broader community. We bring them together annually to work together on these questions of how do we redefine what wealth means personally and as a collective. I think what you should expect from us over the next 5 years is that we continue to amplify solutions that are led by Black women that are really thinking about structural change in different ways and elevating those solutions, as well as naming what are the challenges that we're seeing to the continued creation or pursuit of the creation of wealth in our communities.
And there's something personal in why this is called the Highland Project. I want you to connect that to this amazing mission.
Sure. The two personal things, frankly, about Highland is one, Highland really was birthed out of rest. And I share that because much of our work with leaders is about their own sustainability and not the like hashtag bubble bath, go to the spa culture, but really understanding what does it mean to be in a moment of pause and how can that tap in not only to self-preservation, but into creativity. And so against the backdrop of all things 2020, I had begun a journey on defining rest for myself and what that really would mean. And not to sound like too hippie for you, but I was in a rest practice and the name Highland Project came to me, which leads me to piece two of I was remembering my dad. My dad passed away about a decade ago. He's one of those educators that you never forget. I hated going to the grocery store with him because he was always stopped by a former student. So it was like a 5-hour affair, even years after he retired. And he was also a historian. He loved documenting our culture. And he spent many years documenting the culture and community of Highland Beach, Maryland, which was created by Frederick Douglass and his son as the first Black enclave in Maryland for the talented 10th to gather, to heal, to be in community, to strategize, to choose what they were planting and feeding their souls with, to build homes that would to this day still have stayed in the families of the original Highland Beachers. And as I started to think about what I wanted Highland Project to be, it was just that. It was a place where many could gather. Many could gather to heal, to strategize, and to really redefine what leadership means and what the path forward would look like for our communities.
So when you're selecting this coalition, you're bringing together these Black female leaders, what are you looking for? And probably more importantly, what are they looking for that aligns with this? It's almost this rest to then be prepared to be urgent in other, in so many other ways around this work.
Okay. I think what both sides of the table are looking for, one is the space to be fed, to have your soul fed. and to be sustained. And so I think often in our business planning and in our first round of recruitment and selection, we heard consistently, spaces like this don't exist. Spaces like this don't exist. This is rare. It is rare that Black women have a table to gather at, to solely be them, to talk about the challenges, the opportunities and impact of being a leader. Being a leader in our unique skins and bodies. I think it is rare that those tables cross sectors. It's rare that those tables span generations. And so I think a leader would say to you, Rick, I'm looking for my Fed to be sold, for my soul to be fed. And I'm looking to meet people who I might not otherwise meet, but are doing similar work that I am, pursuing structural change, whether that's changing policy, resource flows, power dynamics, and are bringing a different lens or a different perspective on the work. For us, we're looking for people who really want to continue this lifelong journey of learning, who really are filled by being in pursuit of what we at the Highland Project call mastery over being in a constant dysfunction of success, that they're really always in pursuit of their vision being just beyond their reach, that they are open to figuring out what their own sustainability means, not that they're hidden out of the park. I don't know really who is, but that they see that sustainability is the key to multi-generational change. That's what I think. That's what I know we're looking for. And I think that that's what any leader who you'll meet through the Highland Project would say they're looking for as well.
And give us an example or two of the type of work these amazing women are leading in their community and nationally.
Sure. I think about Mary Pat Hector, who's based right outside of Atlanta in Georgia. She has been organizing her community since she was 10. She was organizing first around the gun violence that was taking too many of her peers' lives way too soon. She ran for office as soon as she could, and which I am reminded of myself in her, because she wanted, she sees the role that policy plays in our communities, and frankly, the dearth of Black women leadership that still exists in key policy positions like Atlanta City Council. She's continued to be an incredible organizer of students as she led protests at her own college around student rights, as she thinks about what does climate justice mean in urban communities. And so I'm really proud that we met Mary Pat, and I'm proud that we're investing in her. I think about our friend Kaya Henderson, who led DC public schools and frankly led a transformation in a countless number of lives of Black children. And she's now asking, right, this question about what does it mean to learn through the eyes of our ancestors in every aspect of what we would traditionally think of as our K-12 schooling, right? And she launched Reconstruction against this notion that Black excellence exists and we actually can learn through the lens of Black excellence. I think about Shelly Jackson in Phoenix, Arizona. Shelly is an organizer of a multiracial coalition in Phoenix. She also invests in the development of leaders at every level, because we know that leadership's needed in the pursuit of structural change. And then she received, you know, I think a similar calling that Mary Pat did, that I did. She ran as a write-in for school board in Phoenix and earned her seat. And so, she's really looking at how do you pursue change through different seats of power that you can hold as a leader.
That all of those are just amazing examples, and it makes me want to learn more about each one of them. And you know, you mentioned Kaya's project of really learning from your ancestors and propagating that learning. And there's something here about and you tell me, like, Black folks doing for Black folks in a way that hasn't always been possible in philanthropy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as we're coming off of Black History Month, we're now in Women's History Month, just having celebrated International Women's Day. There's something really powerful about not just the symbolism, but the actualization of being able to make that happen. And you've shared when we've connected about some just stunning statistics about the capital that is, or in this case, isn't always available to Black women. I'd like you to say maybe a little bit more about that, because I think that's inspired this work for you.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that a big push, something that really pushed me off the ledge to launch Highland, was this notion of getting to action. And that we don't have to wait for others, that it can be for us and by us, that we can invest in ourselves. And so I think your call out of, like, it's actually about the Black community continuing to invest in one another to uplift solutions and to get to a state that's beyond survival, right? But in a sense that we're thriving, that we're experiencing thriving lives, that is something that unites every woman in a Highland cohort. And against the backdrop of philanthropy, what we continue to see writ large, particularly after 2020, is that dollars are not yet catching up to the rhetoric. And so I think a lot about, you know, in 2017, there was a report that not even disaggregating down to Black women and girls, but for women and girls of color, in 2017, less than 1% of philanthropy in the US was going to them. Was going to organizations led them, was going to organizations in pursuit of ensuring they were thriving. Many would think that that number has changed, particularly against, again, the backdrop of 2020 and all of these calls, particularly by corporations, to reckon with racism. And yet what was found was that post 2020, less than 2% of dollars go to women and girls of color. And again, that's not even disaggregated data. And so imagine what those numbers then look like when we apply yet another filter or lens. And I think at heart of some of the lack of movement, I certainly know as someone raising money, is still a scarcity mindset that exists, that even though we have these dollars pledged, that there can really only be a handful of us leading organizations, even though for multiple generations, white-led organizations have had money poured into them, have had entrepreneurs poured into. And I think that too often we continue to hear in fundraising in conversations, oh, well, this organization already exists and there can only be one, or we only need five. And I think that it's past time for us to look at the abundance of Black-led solutions that exist. It's past time that we don't truly invest in them in the ways that we've seen our peers invested in.
Yeah. Well, I think we'll see a reckoning with the reckoning, or at least a reckoning with the significant commitments that were publicly made several years ago, and how that's actually going to those doing some of the hardest work, which is being led by the Black community itself and Black women in particular. It's interesting, the conversation around scarcity, because I think back on a friend who I got to interview on my first of our podcast, Nicole Lynn Lewis at Generation Hope. And she's received funding from organizations like the Black Voices for Black Justice Fund and the 1954 Project from the Cleveland Avenue Foundation. And there does seem to be, again, Black leaders coming together and finding funding. It's not significant enough yet, but it's interesting to contemplate where there may be that scarcity mindset yet still. Like, how do you think about the partnership? Are there partnership opportunities? Where are there ways that all of this really helps drive the work and the sustainability of the community?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot about organizations like our friends at 1954, like Camelback Ventures, And then frankly, us, right? I think that the more that funders can connect with what they might think of as an intermediary organization that is Black or Brown led and created, the opportunities, I would venture to guess, are endless. And I think that I think a big part of the problem is a scarcity mindset. I think others would also say it's about people need time to figure out how they're going to redo their application processes, right? To find the leaders, grow their networks so they're not seeing the same faces. And I think organizations like a Highland, like a 1954, we're already proximate. We already have those networks built. And so I think for a funder who's listening, questioning, how can I move more quickly? My advice to them would be to find us, find a 1954, find a Camelback. We have the infrastructure in place. We have the networks in place, and we're investing in real structural change that will be here to last. So find us would be my recommendation.
Yeah. And I think it's a nuanced message, which is, you know, to your point, there is a need for more, but there are also organizations like yourselves and the ones you just mentioned that are there that, as you said, know the community. Yes. You know, I mean, how many leaders did you talk to come upon the first cohort?
Sure. We had 160 nominations through what we call the Legacy Network. It's a group of individuals and organizations who will nominate annually for our first 5 years. We had 120 leaders who we invited to apply. If we were recording this back in October, I would have sounded exhausted because we were in conversation with 64 beyond exceptional leaders. And I think that what I knew at my core, my team and I saw up close and personal, which is decades of underinvestment in the worthiness of Black women leaders. And to go from 64 to 15 was incredibly challenging because it was not that a leader didn't check a box. And in fact, at the beginning of this year, we said that pretty loud and clear, I hope, in an open letter that we wrote to the broader Highland community, that not seeing a woman not placed in the first cohort is not a reflection of, is she a good enough leader? Is she good enough at her job? Do we see her impact? But rather it represents the decades of underinvestment and frankly, under consideration that we were created to solve for.
What, I mean, just stunning the number of unbelievable women that you met with, you got to know, and what should their experience be from here? I know you've been thinking about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what I hope continues for leaders who met us and deeply engaged with us in our first year is that they continue to join our community and see that our community is a place for rest and reflection, even if they are not placed yet in a cohort. And so what do I mean by that? We focus on designing a selection process that created space to rest. So the first interaction that leaders had with the Highland Project was resting with my rest coach, frankly, Octavia Raheem. They experienced an application process that had them reflect on the legacy that they were making, because we knew we would always have fewer seats, right, than we had leaders. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to give leaders the space for questioning, the space for reflection. We heard that we would accomplish that in our selection process. And so what would happen if you, Rick, were a leader who was not yet placed this year is that you'll continue to be brought into our community. You'll continue to experience opportunities with Octavia and exploring your rest vision. You would continue to experience opportunities with us to reflect on your legacy, to be in conversation with other leaders. And you would continue to experience with us what we passionately call Highland Hours, which really is an opportunity to be just in the community that we met over the past year, to be sitting in the wisdom of other Black women leaders on different topics every quarter. But it's been something that I think has helped to keep us together and frankly be a marker in our work of where we're different.
Mm-hmm. We could talk about this for hours and days, and I hope if nothing else, our conversation inspires folks who don't know Highland yet to get to know them and to get to know you a little bit in the way that I have over the last several years. As we're closing, would just love maybe some thoughts from you. I think I know what the answer to this question is, but I've got to ask it, which is you're deep in work that reveals some things that haven't changed in a very long time, that continue not to change. And as you said, make bare how underinvested Black women in particular have been. What gives you hope?
This cohort, frankly. And not just the cohort, but the network of supports and infrastructure that's around them. Every leader receives a coach. They receive two strategic advisors. They receive the full support of our governing structure in terms of access to the networks. And I can't not believe that we aren't all here at this very place and time for some profound reason. And it's not a coincidence. When I look at this cohort, when I look at the leaders supporting this cohort, it can't be just coincidence. That's what I just believe in my heart of hearts. And that's what gets me up in the morning to keep working, to keep raising money, to keep designing programming, is knowing that this space that we've created, or I should say that we've begun to create, I know it is rare. And every leader we work with knows it is rare. And that something really beautiful is going to come of it. That's what keeps me going.
Thank you for listening to From Idea to Impact. To learn more about the guests featured on this podcast and the work we do at Arabella Advisors, please visit our website at www.arabellaadvisors.com.